better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. Santa Claus is coming to town. Santa Claus is coming to town. He's making a list. He's checking it twice. He's gonna find out who's naughty or nice. Santa Claus is coming to town.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Pop Culture Ninja. I'm Nathan, here with Nathan. Nathan, what's going on, man?
We're closer to the holidays than we were before. We are very close to Christmas now.
We are indeed. When, you know, we're playing this, actually, the week of Christmas is when we're doing this episode. So we thought we'd have a little fun with it, you know, being just a few days before Christmas, and kind of do what we did at Thanksgiving. Talk a little family, talk a little friends, talk a little tradition. And we're going to hopefully talk a lot of Santa today. So excited
to be
warned. Yeah, exactly. So if
there's anyone listening here who doesn't understand Santa's actual origins, if you are certain he'll be visiting you this year, perhaps you should just turn this off and not listen.
That's right.
By the same token, I don't think we are out disavowing Santa. So if there's anyone out there who is not looking for a pro Santa podcast,
that's right. that's great. Let's kind of roll into some things here, Nathan. Let's start off and just talk about Christmas growing up. What was Christmas kind of like for you and your family as you were growing up?
Christmas was, for me, it was always a really interesting time, because I think it's strange to say, I'm sure people will maybe not know what to do with this initially. Halloween and Christmas, when growing up, had some similarities to me, mostly because of the imaginative aspect. Of course, the difference for us growing up, and I think I mentioned this previously, growing up in a Baptist home and a Baptist family, religion, specifically Christianity, was always a big part of Christmas. So, yes, growing up, I learned everything that the Bible and related tradition had to say about Christmas. So that was always a perspective, baby Jesus, the angels, the birth of Christ, and things like that. That was always a part of it. But at the same time, my family, I wouldn't say that we believed in Santa Claus, but Santa Claus was something that was allowed to be sort of a fun part of the holiday. I think that while I remember talking about and being very young and thinking about Santa Claus coming down the chimney and stuff like that, that to me it was always just a kind of another imaginative part of the holiday. Even thinking back recently, having discussions with a lot of people who clearly remember at some point believing in Santa, I don't know if I ever had that moment where I remember deeply, deeply believing, okay, he's coming, he's on the roof, and things like that. There was always a sense of play to it, to me. That doesn't mean it's necessary for everybody. So for me, you had all the things you could come with the other holidays, family and things like that. But the lead up to Christmas, I felt like my parents were really good about a sort of encouraging and an imaginative sort of playful mood. But at the same time, there was an emphasis on something a little bit more, which I think is where the kind of Baptist upbringing came in. But I was never at a point where one thing eclipsed the other. To me, Santa and everything else, the Christmas tree, they were all sort of paraphernalia that all tied back into the central Christmas story. But that has a lot to do with how it was portrayed. Growing up, I read a lot too. So each additional year when I could read just a little bit more, there was always sort of adding that, like, whether it's folklore or stories, that sort of thing, really informed a lot of how I felt about Christmas. So Christmas was, you know, it was a time to celebrate in the religious sense, but it was also a time to kind of celebrate imagination at the same time, which to me would be the only real dovetail with Halloween. They were both holidays that sort of encouraged a playfulness, a time when adults would be a little bit more playful than they might be at another time of the year, particularly in regards to children and imagination.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. And I think you and I probably had similar upbringings. You know, I don't I think when I was younger, I remember vaguely, you know, that time of believing in Santa, and then getting into school, you know, it was just kind of like being around other people. It was like, oh, Santa, he's not real. He doesn't exist. You know, other families who didn't believe, other children who didn't believe. And I don't remember it being like devastating, though. You know, I remember talking to my parents about it, and they said, well, you know, he's a myth. You know, he's larger than life. And I've come to appreciate that aspect of the imagination that you were talking about with Santa Claus. In fact, I've mentioned this on these Go to 11, but my favorite decorations that we have in our house, or some of my favorite decorations that we have in our house, are one is a picture of Santa Claus holding the baby Jesus. You know,
he's not putting him in a sack or anything.
No. Not Krampus. Not Krampus.
Well, there's a Russian Santa that puts kids into the sack, so it isn't
no,
Krampus.
No. You know, he's just lovingly holding him. He's got a tear coming down his eye. And that's just one of my favorite pictures. And then we have a couple of ornaments where it's just this scene where Santa is, you know, in front of a fireplace that has a cross on it, and he's just kneeling before the cross. And for me, that was always great, because you and I have talked about this. I love the imagination of Tolkien and Lewis, and Tolkien was very big on, you know, all these myths that we make up as humans are essentially shadows that point to the one true myth. That is God, that is Christ coming into this world. And so I always love that interaction between the myth that is Santa Claus and the interaction that he has in our world. You know, and C.S. Lewis writes that well in Narnia, you know, where Santa Claus comes and brings the children gifts, even in the world of Narnia.
Right. And actually, some of the big fantasy authors, and two of which you pointed out being Christians, when I say big fantasy authors from a different era of writing fantasy, not what we would think of today as fantasy authors. You mentioned two, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, and of course, Lewis brings Santa Claus into the first Narnia book, the actual first book, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, mm-hmm. and he comes as a sort of precursor to Aslan before he shows up. You know, he sort of is bringing he's the tail end of winter as spring is about to finally show up for the first time in a long time. Mm-hmm. And so he's a kind of harbinger in those books that I remember. I don't actually remember. I don't believe Father Christmas showed up anywhere else in the Narnia books.
No,
did he, Nathan?
No, it was just the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
And it's also notable that, you know, he provides the children. He sort of gives them gifts of weapons.
Yes. But that's a good Santa Claus right there.
Yeah, he's kind of like a Viking Claus. When they made, I guess, the most recent film version, the big budget Hollywood versions, and they had James Cosmo, who you've seen him in other movies like Highlander and Braveheart.
Yes, yeah.
And now he's Santa Claus, and he's a really rugged kind of a Santa Claus. I love the look of Santa and his sleigh in that movie. It had a very kind of Norse sort of feel.
Yes.
Which is appropriate because Santa Claus's origination kind of it comes from a good chunk of who he is now comes from the myths of Odin in Norse mythology, kind of the all-father kind of flying across the sky. I think Odin had like a seven-legged horse or something, and of course eventually, you know, we have reindeer and sleigh. The second one Tolkien wrote, the Father Christmas letters that he actually wrote for his children. Like they were letters from Father Christmas. They involved like polar bears and goblins. And are you familiar with this?
I'm not actually. It does not surprise me because of everything he did, but no, I am not actually familiar with it.
No, yeah. So he wrote like letters from Santa, and they were published as letters from Father Christmas, and Tolkien, he wrote them and he illustrated them between like a 20-year span between 1920 and 1942. He did it for his kids, and he did them from Father Christmas. So here you have – and again, I think this is a lot to do with like kind of culture and generational things. You know, at this point in time, I think Tolkien, he had a strong faith, and I think he had a strong interest in fantasy and storytelling. And for Tolkien, he was able to hold both of those things in separate places.
Mm.
And one, as you said, informed the other in a sense. But and I think he drew lines between them. I feel like we encounter sometimes a mentality that behaves as if these two things cannot exist, which I've said in previous podcasts that for me, my faith is something that is deep and personal. And so something like Santa Claus or a imaginative fictional tradition, I don't put them on the same groundwork. So there's never a competition for me, you know.
Yeah.
Growing up, I saw that on a daily basis, my parents valued their faith in a way that this belief in God was a regular recurring thing. It also informed how they treated other people. It informed the way they behaved on a day-to-day basis. So those things showed me that there was something different between the stories about Santa Claus and the stories about Christ. Now, I think in there, there's probably, I'm not going to belabor it, but there's probably a good takeaway for everyone who's thinking about that concept. You know, for me, we do Santa Claus with the kids, but my kids also are aware, not simply aware, but understand to the extent that I think it's appropriate, the Christmas story and all of those elements. But it is fun to kind of have those imaginative talks with the kids. We don't have an actual fireplace, so my son was trying to figure out how he would get through the electric fireplace that we have. Finally settling on the idea that he'll probably just turn into a red ball, much like the blob, and come down and just leak out through the grate and then reform. This is what a generation raised on superhero movies believes about Santa Claus now.
Nice. So, nice.
But even my son, I believe if you were to sit there and really watch him, he's playing an imaginative game. The way he talks about other things, and God being one of those, that they don't line up quite with Santa Claus, who seems to exist more in the land of play. Right. So the third author was Frank L. Baum, who, of course, is well known for The Wizard of Oz. And Baum did a book that was kind of – or a story that was pretty crazy that was The Life and Adventures of Santa Claus. This also had Santa Claus fighting goblins and growing up in a land of immortals. They made a kind of cool, fun Rankin-Bass animated movie about it.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, Santa Claus gets lost and he's in the forest of Burzee, which is kind of like Middle Earth a little bit.
Yes.
And he gets picked up by the Master Woodsman and there's a lioness that raises him and he eventually – But in this story, you do have a Santa Claus, and I think it's probably safe to say that in all three variations of the Santa we've just talked about, he isn't just this consumer sort of symbol. He's a symbol that sort of points back to a desire for charity and for service and for kind of selfless love, particularly in relation to children. And so those elements – in the two cases, the first two cases, they are sort of specifically pointing back, I think, at God, particularly most notably in the case of Lewis, not maybe so much with Baum, but I think that's fine. He's telling a fantasy story about a fantasy character, but he's imbuing it with something that has some resonance, some real world resonance, which would be that love. And those people who latch on to Santa Claus, the people who do the professional Santa Clausing. I mean, I'm sure there's some people cash in a paycheck, but we've got documentaries out there about these guys who just, they really embody this feeling. For them, he's a symbol of something that goes beyond. No one thinks they're the real Santa Claus, but
right. If
Santa Claus is a spirit of Christmas, and I don't mean spirit like flying around and waving his arms, then for them, it embodies the holiday and they get something out of it. So.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's something to note too. Is you know there is something that is natural about you know being more charitable this time of the year, and again, not always, you know, and particularly where we've come with being more materialistic, with it being more of a commercialized holiday, you know, those things don't. I'm not going to say they're, you know, they're exclusive of one another, but, you know, there is a sense of, oh, you know, this is a time where we want to open up our purse strings a little more freely and give a little more freely. You know, you typically will have, you know, for tax purposes, I'll throw that out there, but you have people who will typically give more to charities this time of the year. I think December is, by far the largest donation month, monetary wise, to charities. You also have things like Operation Christmas Child. My wife, and our exchange student had the opportunity to go down to Odenton with, here in Maryland with, about 30 to 40 parents and students to pack boxes. And, you know, so there is more that is going on in that way of charity and giving. And I think a lot of that, whether you're a Christian or not, you know, you see that stemming from the giving that comes from Santa Claus, or the giving that we associate with Christ, giving him himself to come to earth. And I think that is something that, again, whether you're Christian or not, people really tend to cling to and hold to, and a theme that you see throughout this entire month.
Yeah. And I think the thing too, it's that for most of my experience, and I guess I do have the experience of growing up in a home where we did the whole Santa Claus thing. It never felt unnatural or strange. I mean, it was never a competition. That when I do encounter that other perspective, you know, I personally do not believe that the Santa Claus mythology is harmful. It does, of course, depend on how you handle it and what you do with it and everything like that. Mm-hmm. That's my feeling on it. Again, I think there's an imaginative element, there's a creative element, and there's a way in which it can be dovetailed in with everything else that is not, and it is in competition. It hasn't confused my children. I do not expect my children to turn to me and say, well, Santa Claus isn't real, so therefore God's not real either.
Right, right.
That nature. First off, from a spiritual perspective, you're not depending on the words, your words or anyone else's words, to be the convincing factor whether your child ultimately believes in God. And I think that's, you know,
right.
If you believe there's a difference there, then you believe there's a difference there. And I, you know, to speak on that further, I think it is difficult with the level where Santa Claus has become this commercial icon, and it has also become a secular sort of icon. That's a whole different discussion. But I am kind of fascinated by the character because, I mean, he does, first off, he is a Judeo-Christian character.
Right.
And it's funny because as soon as you get into this really PC world where people don't want to put Santa Claus on Christmas cards anymore, and you know, everyone gets offended, oh, but we're taking Christ out of Christmas, but now, you know, now you're on Santa's side. It's hard to tell.
Right
it's hard to tell where that goes. I mean, he's a Christian figure to begin with, and the Christian figure is interesting, I think. So that'd be kind of cool to talk about that. I do want to ask you, Nathan, so in a situation with someone who has kids, do you think, what do you think about participating in the entire Santa Claus tradition?
Yeah, I let me just throw this out there, because I do have friends who, you know, believe that, well, you know, we don't let our kids believe in Santa. You know, we feel like we're lying to them, and, you know, all this stuff. I'm just going to throw this out there. In this capacity, it is something that I would enjoy lying to my children about. To me, and I think you can even approach it if your conscience is one that you're like, well, I'm lying to my children and I can't do that. So if your conscience is one where, you know, you can't do that, I think there's still a way to approach this and enjoy this and make it, like you said, just a playful, fun thing, you know, for this time of the year.
Give me an approach to storytelling. I think the Tolkien approach is interesting. Is this lying? He's writing letters from Santa. He's sort of adopting this persona. As when we talk about Santa Claus with our children, which isn't really all that – I mean, it's like, oh, here's where he plays a part. But it's really more, again, like storytelling. And my children and I have a game back and forth where we'll play storytelling about all kinds of things. But we aren't sitting there saying, by the way, this is a story, you know.
Right.
Oh, you know, the goblins in the backyard. My child will come and start talking about goblins. By exploring where he's going with this and saying, well, what do the goblins do? What do they look like? I'm not really trying to encourage him to believe in the goblins in the backyard.
Right.
And so there is – I think we have lost a little bit of that nuance. I think part of it is because – and I'm going to say this. I don't – I think that we have lost touch a little bit with some of our more, particularly within a religious spectrum. I think that where things were at a different point, people were maybe encouraged to be a little bit more imaginative. I'm not talking about being more imaginative with scripture,
right,
or
right.
with what you believe to be the truth of your faith,
right.
But that in other areas, not really feeling that engaging in imagination or fancifulness is somehow the same as lying.
Right.
And that would really be that's a whole different podcast, really. But
sure.
And I would say this too, that it's we're not telling anybody what to do or what to think.
Right.
At all. I just kind of, for me, it's always been a non-issue. It's just fun to sort of engage. But as we're talking about this episode, I don't think the goal of this is not necessarily to convince anybody, obviously, of the merit of Santa Claus, but just to talk about the tradition and how it played out. So, and to me, I never had any family members dressing up like Santa Claus or anything like that. I mean, we have a friend now who dresses up like the traditional sort of Father Christmas.
Right, right.
Which you were a recipient of last year.
Yes.
When he showed up.
That was fantastic.
But you know, something I'll say about that, and this is a good segue. That particular year, Nathan, you came over. We had a whole full house of people. But me personally, I was down a bit because we lost a very close family member last year, less than a week before Christmas. And they had been sick for a while. But, I mean, it was still a very hard – I mean, the week of Christmas, 2 to 3 days before Christmas Day, we were burying this person. Yes. And it really kind of took the wind out of our sails. It just wasn't really interested. It was hard to even connect. And this is with even having the kids and trying to be caught up in what they're doing with it. And so he shows up at our house on Christmas evening with a house full of people, some he knew, some he did not, like yourselves. He had not met until that night. And he shows up in full. I would say that the look is the Ghost of Christmas Present from the Christmas Carol.
Yes.
By Charles Dickens. I mean, full blown thing. And, in fact, I might see if I can get his permission to put his picture up. But he had the full thing going. I mean, it was the Ghost of Christmas Present, but also that's the British kind of view of Father Christmas. And he came in with this sack of presents. He had a present in that bag for every single person in the room.
Yes.
He had written – would poetry be right? Rhymes at least?
Yeah. Little
– single present, and yes, it's specifically tailored to the people in the room, and based on the extent that he knew what he knew. I think he even had an iPod somewhere on his person that was playing, like,
yes, it was
Christmas music. Yes. And he came into the thing, and you know, obviously my children are like, hey, that's your friend, we know who that is, and there was no question of hey. But, you know, I think that really did something for everybody's spirits that were there in that room. You know, there was sort of a reminder about kind of coming out of your whatever's going on with you at that moment. For us, being a little sad, being a little down, there was a reminder of charity, of generosity, of imagination, of playfulness. Like, he kind of saved the Christmas in a sense for me personally. You know, I don't know what anybody else thought, but to everyone else, it might have simply been amusing, but I think it just changed the whole tone for me, you know?
Yes. Yeah. And I, you know, it was funny that you said that because I remember Joy and I had to leave a little earlier than we would have liked to because we had to get back to our boy. But I was in the car and we were driving home and I just looked at it and I said, that was so much fun. And to your point, Nathan, it is something that I had been looking for in a Christmas for a very long time as well, because for the past several years I'd been working at the liquor store, so my holidays were very quick, very rushed, and they had been steeped in the commercialization of what we've been talking about. And so I never felt like I truly was able to sit down and just appreciate the holiday. Christmas Day was usually running from one family member to another, doing this, that, and the other. And for us, the whole day was just a great day to sit down, relax. I was able to play some video games with my brother and then head over to your house and enjoy that evening. It's something that I know for me personally, I will always remember and cherish because of the time of my life that I was in.
Yeah, and I think that there's an element there, and this is not getting away from the importance of your faith or the importance of sharing that faith.
Right,
but
right.
I think that sometimes there are wrong-headed things. There's been two – if we have a moment, there are two interesting stories this week Santa-related that are kind of on the opposite spectrums of one another. And I suspect that if these two individuals ever met, they would have maybe they probably wouldn't see very eye-to-eye on these things.
Yes.
But, you've had the one story, which I think has probably been touted quite a bit lately, with the I guess he's a pastor, I don't really know, but also apparently trying to become a YouTube celebrity, who has gone into a shopping mall somewhere and is basically just starting to tell everyone that those Santa's not real and that man's a liar and, you know, he's just a guy in a suit and you should believe in Jesus, you know. To me, a profoundly wrong-headed way to evangelize.
Yes.
Particularly because of how divisive, how seemingly destructive, and him taking a certain amount of joy in it, you know, his approach. And yes. So I think that story has a very – I don't know. To me, it kind of hits the taste buds the wrong way. What do you mm-hmm. think?
Oh, yeah. I completely agree. First and foremost – you know, as Christians, I think we need to, first of all, show a little more compassion to people. And second of all, realize that where the scripture is completely silent on things, we as believers should be silent. I think we should have our convictions. We should let our conscience dictate what we do in our families. But once that extends to outside the family, you're crossing a line that I would argue the Bible would condemn you for, maybe not condemn in a harsh, you know, you're going to hell sense, but would very much look down on that and would have strong wording for you on that, you know.
Would not support it.
Exactly.
That would probably be in consideration there. That's not to say that necessarily the thing he's expressing, there may be many people that agree with that, but
that's not the time and the place. Right.
Issue, yeah.
Right.
I can think a lot of things, but if I express it by, you know, hitting my neighbor with an oar before I share that, it doesn't really
– Yes.
It doesn't excuse that part where I hit him with the oar.
That's right.
So – and then there was another article I was going – I've been really trying to like just like glance and dart at like MSN and things like that because I'm like so afraid to see what new ridiculousness is in the news.
Yes.
So I'm sort of just glancing and looking for like where's the link to my email?
Right, right.
I can get in and get back out without being sullied. And a little bit of an exaggeration, perhaps not much. And come across this picture of this guy with a beautiful Santa beard and this wonderfully, like, it's so thick and yet it's still curled on the ends.
Yes.
I mean, it's like the quintessential Santa. You see this picture, right? Like
yes.
The link I say. I mean, that's Santa Claus.
Yes, yes.
But when I read the story that's attached to it, I mean, this is an emotional story.
Yes.
Now, have you read it?
Yes, I got a chance to read it shortly before we went on the air. And actually, what I'd like to do is in the show notes for this episode, I'll post the link to that story in the show notes for people.
This was kind of a gutting thing, and I don't want to make too many comments on it because there's lots of things to take in and consider about it. But Eric Schmitz-Matson is the name of the guy with the awesome Santa beard, and he is a kind of professional Santa. It seems to be, as you read this article, that he's really a guy who does it for the love of being Santa Claus. You know,
yes.
not the love he's necessarily getting from children, but embodying this person, if you will, of Santa Claus. And I think that, you know, growing up, it does dawn on me that a lot of people have cased it that way, that when you grow up and learn that there is no Santa Claus, at that point, that's when you have the opportunity to, in a sense, become Santa Claus to somebody else. You know, that we're not talking about a real guy, obviously, that lives at the North Pole.
Right.
We're not even necessarily talking about commemorating the real but embellished guy that did exist.
Right.
Saint Nicholas.
Right.
But we're talking about something that's a little bit more symbolic.
Well, and if I could throw something in here real quick, Nathan, to kind of equalize this, you know, we most of the time we have no problem with our children fantasizing about being superhero characters, Captain America, Wolverine, you know, Iron Man, things like that. But for some reason, we take issue and offense with Santa. And I would encourage people, you know, maybe think about it along those lines. You know, this is a character. We have an image of what this person is. And so someone is taking on the persona of that character to bring joy to other people.
And then, so, yeah, and that's what's happening here. So you have this guy who he's doing the Santa thing. And he finds himself in a scenario. And this is a guy that used to be an Army Ranger, by the way.
Yes. Yeah.
He was with the Army Rangers for 3 years. So this is a guy, you know, he has a kind of varied career here. He gets called to a hospital where he's basically – he knew a nurse and he's been involved with people at the hospital. And she says, hey, there's a really sick kid in this hospital, he wants to see Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, okay, I'd be happy to do that. Let me change. Let me get ready, get in the outfit. And she just says, there's no time for that. You just bring the suspenders and come now. And again, this dude in the suspenders, he looks the part.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't need
the coat and all that. Yeah.
He gets to the hospital in like 15 minutes. And then when he realizes when he gets there is the kid's mother and there's a ton of family members there. And the kid, 5-year-old boy, is dying, you know, and she has this like little Paw Patrol toy and she wants him to go in and give it to the boy. He basically is like, look, if you think you're going to lose it, please leave the room, because if you're crying, I'm going to break down too. And so nobody goes in with him. He goes into the little boy's room, which is in the intensive care unit, and he's there, and the kid's like on his deathbed. Like he said, he's like ready to fall asleep. He says, you know, and he does a Santa Claus stick. Oh, you can't miss Christmas. You're my number one elf. And, you know, he's like, hey, I am. And he's like, sure. And he's giving him the present, and he said, you know, the kid's barely able to open the wrapping paper, but, you know, he's really happy when he sees the present. And then he says to him, you know, he says, I'm going to die. How can I tell where I get to when I – how can I tell when I get to where I'm going? Like, how will I know? And so this guy, I'm sure, is like he doesn't know what to do with this. And, you know, at this point, maybe somebody says, oh, this is where you share the gospel. We don't know anything about the spiritual nature of what's going on with this kid or his family. The guy's there doing Santa Claus.
Right.
Can you do me a big favor? The kid says, sure. And he says, when you get there, tell them you're Santa's number one elf, and I know they'll let you in. And, you know, he says, oh, they will. And he's playing this game with the kid. And I don't know if he knows how close he is, you know, like. And he says the kid gives him up, sets up, and it's really hard and difficult for the kid to sit up. But he says, you know, he just didn't have much energy to play now. He gives him a big hug. He says, Santa, can you help me? And he puts his arms around him. And before he can say anything, the kid just dies.
Yeah.
Like in his arms. And you know, he's saying like the woman is, his mother is screaming, no, no, not yet. And he's having to give the kid back and like basically run out of the room. And, I mean, he sounds like he's messed up for a while, you know, in a sense, like he's just like, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
But you know, the next time he goes back out there, he sees the kids and he kind of reminds him and it clicks him back in. You know,
yeah,
and I am doing this. You know, I'm doing it for them, and I'm doing it for me. And there's and I don't think that that's solely a selfish statement. You know, but that's and there's lots of ways to probably approach or even criticize that story. But and Lord help me, because I know they're going to make a song out of it, and then I'm going to hate it. But to me, with a kid, having a kid who's 5 years old, about to be five. That's a kind of a – that was a hard-hitting story for me. And I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there. But, you know, there's an element and I think – then a role there that's occurring. And, you know, I think there are some positive things there.
Yes.
What did you think about this?
Yeah, I agree. You know, things like this always always touch my heart because, you know, on both levels, you know, because here's a guy, you know, like you said, he's a former Army Ranger. He's seen death before, you know, but the way he describes holding this 5-year-old as he dies in his arms is just it'll bring you to tears because it is such an emotional thing. You know, he said he's running past the nurse's station and he's bawling. And like you said, it literally just wrecked him where, he didn't think he could ever play Santa again. You know, he was supposed to go and visit his, children and grandchildren in Tennessee the next day. And he just told his wife, you need to go without me. He was just so wrecked that he could not do this. And to me, there is such love and compassion and tenderness in there that, you know what, Christians, you know, because you talked about that spirituality aspect of it. As Christians, can we set that aside and forget the shoulda, woulda, couldas and just look at this story as a story of such compassion and grace from one person to another? And I think that's something that we need to take with us, you know, as Christians, as people,
And I'd say this, it's irrelevant really whether you celebrate or don't celebrate Santa Claus, but being able to embrace in a real way and appreciate that in others, I think is important.
Yes. Yes. And I agree 100% with that. Dude, we're kind of running low on time here, and we didn't
talk about the evil Santa.
I know.
I didn't get to talk about the time St. Nicholas slapped a heretic in the face.
I know.
Are you familiar with that?
Yes, actually, I did recently hear that, but it was just this year that I heard that story.
Yeah, and I guess we have a couple minutes enough that we could probably discuss like the background.
Yeah, yeah.
What St. Nicholas' character, like, and when I say the character, we're really talking about who realistically was a real bishop, but probably most of the stories that are known about him are not are embellished.
Yes,
has a sense of a almost Robin Hood figure.
Yes,
to him now.
Yeah.
But at one time.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I mean, you know, so I just wanted to give a little bit of background kind of in, you know, this St. Nicholas character. You know, we have the feast day, St. Nicholas Day, which is actually December 6th in the Advent season, not the 25th. So, you know, components of that, you know, there are a lot of similarities in what we see with St. Nicholas and, you know, where he's, you know, benevolent, he's giving gifts, you know, he's doing all these things to help people. And, you know, one of the things that, in history is that a lot of times, you know, there are parties and celebrations that are held on the eve, which is December 5th. You know, and he leaves presents and stockings and, you know, so there are a lot of similarities of things that,
funny note about the guy, the Santa Claus, Eric, that we were just talking about.
Yes.
He's born on December 6th.
Oh, so there you go.
Yeah.
So he's born on the
6th. Yeah. He was born to be Santa.
That's right. Literally. You know, so to me, like those things are just kind of interesting side notes on, you know, some of the origins and some of the beginnings of what we started to see as the holiday and the celebration of this person. So go ahead and take us back, Nathan, to the original
80 years after the birth of Christ.
That's right.
There was a man, but he was Greek. I mean, he was born in, he was the bishop of Myra. It's a small Roman town, I guess, at that mm-hmm. point in what's now like modern Turkey. So he wasn't really fat. I don't know how jolly he was smacking heretic, but
I don't know. When I smack people, I'm pretty jolly.
I mean, well, that's a whole different story. You just negated half of what you said. But the interesting thing about him is he was really, I mean, the Santa element we could talk about, but he was also a really kind of firebrand kind of defender of the church doctrine kind of guy. Like,
yeah.
I don't know how much, but you know, it's interesting because I think a lot of perhaps Christians, particularly those that are, they're very much about scripture and things like that, might've, you know, they might've been a little more impressed by this guy. I mean, this is a guy operating during what we consider the Great Persecution. You know what I mean?
Yes.
The point when they're burning Bibles and they're killing priests and people are renouncing Christianity. I mean, This Nicholas, if we're to believe all the stories, he spent some time in jail for this.
Yes.
I mean, yep. It's not really until Constantine brings the Christianity, we're sort of all over the empire, that he's even released from prison. So, you know, there's stories that involve miracles, some kind of creepy stories too. Like, to go back though, he essentially inherits, his parents are Christians. He inherits a great amount of money from them, and he basically becomes rich. So instead of sort of taking this, stockpiling it, or running for president or whatever, what he does is that he starts giving it away, and it becomes a sort of Robin Hood almost element, minus the part where you steal it first.
Right.
So, but what's interesting is we're not just talking about delivering gifts for kids. I mean, the better known, or like probably one of the best known stories, involves where he's actually, there's a group of women, I think they're actually, I don't know if they're sisters or not, I think they are sisters, because there's a father who's basically about to turn, he's being forced to turn his girls over to what would, I guess, is going to end up being a life of prostitution.
Right. Yeah.
Because of a debt that he owes. And Nicholas, Bishop Nicholas, at this point, he throws the gold up, not as in vomits up, but throws it, I guess, up in through the window or whatever. And the father can then use those for dowries for the women. So they, you know, they get saved from this this life of prostitution. So it's not simply that there's money, that there's gifts involved. He's trying to do something kind of philanthropic with a Christian bent in order, and I think this is the important element, he's trying to reduce the suffering of others, you know, a phrase we've heard. You know, he's trying to look out for others in their lives, people who are less fortunate, obviously.
Yes.
And so there's one weird story. The creepy story I'm talking about is he apparently comes across, and this is more apocryphal, I'm sure. He goes into an inn where the innkeepers just murdered three kids and put their bodies in barrels, pickle barrels, I guess.
Mm.
And yeah. Mm. And the bishop not only, you know, he's not just aware that this has happened, but he brings them back. So it's got a happy ending. I guess that once he brought them back, they were sort of restored and not pickled and all that kind of gross stuff, because that would have been problematic.
They didn't turn into Krampus?
No. They didn't become his elves or anything like that I could tell. But this is sort of one of those things that makes him a patron saint of children. He comes in, he discovers the crime, and he resurrects the kid. So obviously kind of apocryphal. But and then eventually we get in where, you know, some of the European gods and deities and folklore characters start to sort of get layered onto this. And it's funny because then what happens is at some point, you know, all over the place, some of these characters start getting picked up. Germany kind of latches on, but starts turning them into, you know, these kind of more rugged, creepier characters.
Right, and right.
Lapland has the Yule lads, which are basically trolls that kind of just have some of the same similarities as Santa Claus. The Pell's Nickel is the kind of furry Nicholas, which is kind of creepy in and of itself. He's a guy that likes to throw the kids in the sacks too. Of course, Saint Nicholas, when he comes, starts as a Sinterklaas when he comes to America.
Right.
When Martin Luther tries to kind of disband that or kind of replace him with the Christ child, which ultimately becomes what that term comes out to is Kris Kringle. So that doesn't really work either.
Yeah.
He eventually just comes back to being Santa Claus in a sense, the Christ child, where it's now there's a heavier Christian influence with him. But him smacking the heretic is a story that apparently happens when once they bring all the Christian bishops together in Nicaea. So the records in Nicaea don't really have any record of Santa Claus rolling up in here. They also don't have any record that I'm aware of him rolling up and smacking somebody.
Yeah.
But supposedly they're debating the Trinity, you know, they're the Jesus, the God, the Father, and the Holy Spirit. And one of the bishops, guess what? Guess who it was? Nicholas. He gets so ticked off that the guy who's Arius, who's standing there talking about there's no Trinity, that he gets up and slaps him across the face. So of all the Santa Claus stories out there, the polar bears and the goblins, you have Santa Claus smacking somebody in the face who is talking smack on the Trinity.
Yeah.
So there you go, Christians. Santa Claus, defender of the Trinity.
That's right.
Not just in spirit, but in concept.
That's right. Literally.
And, you know? And you know what? I guess that means that Feast of St. Nicholas, Nathan, maybe in the spirit of things, maybe you should just slap a heretic.
That's
no,
right.
No.
No, I take that back. Don't do that.
Yes. Find a heretic and give them a bottle of Mad Elf and sit down and have a talk.
Yes. That is totally the way I will go.
Yeah, that's probably a good note to close on.
Yes. All right. So we, this has been fun. I'm looking forward to doing this next year and, maybe trying to bring out a little bit more, maybe doing something a little bit different. You know,
a full Krampus episode.
That's right. That's right. Pull your children around the radio.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. All right, man. Well, we're going to go ahead and sign off and we'll catch y'all later.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
Really shook the pillars of heaven, didn't we, Wayne?